difficulties.
Good afternoon. I call to order the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Wednesday, May 25th. Good afternoon. And we have just one hearing today, so we are going to open an informational hearing. Do I gavel for that? On insurer responsibility for investigating auto accident liability. And we'll hear from our colleague, Representative Gomberg.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the beautiful Oregon coast, where I hope that you'll all bring your families on vacation this Memorial weekend. I'm pleased to be with you, and I do appreciate the invitation to come here and talk to you about an issue that that came to my attention very recently. And I'm just going to share with you a story today, if I may. And I'm going to skip to the end of the story and then back up and fill in a little detail. And the end of the story is a letter that I just had distributed from an insurance company, which says, "This letter is regarding the loss you recently reported to our company. We have made numerous attempts to contact our policyholder regarding this claim. Unfortunately, all of our efforts have been unsuccessful. Without contact from our policyholder, an objective police report taken at the scene of the accident, or an independent witness, we will be unable to take any further action on this claim. As a result, we're unable to make any payments to you for the damages that you sustained in this loss at this time." The short version being, our policyholder didn't reply to us. The claim is denied. Now, here's the story that prefaces this letter, and it's, as I said, it's a simple story about a van traveling down Highway 101 that stops at a construction site, and the vehicle right behind them doesn't stop quite as quickly, and there's a minor fender bender, about $800 in total damages to the vehicle in the front. They're in an area with no cell service. And I'll let you surmise for yourselves whether if they were able to make a phone call to the Oregon State Police, how long it might have taken to get a response in rural Tillamook County to an $800 fender bender. But the people involved in the accident did all the right things. They exchanged information, driver's license numbers, insurance information, car registrations and license plates. The driver took pictures. They also then contacted the flagger who was working at the construction site and got their name. And when they got home, they filled out an accident report for DMV, and then they waited. And the answer they got back, as you see, is, gee, we tried to contact our policyholder. They won't return any of our phone calls or respond to any of our letters. And unless you have a report from a police officer or an independent witness, if our policyholder doesn't reply to us, you lose. I was a little startled by this fact scenario, and you know, it seemed to me you go into a courtroom if you have a dispute that's resolved in court, and one side shows up and the other one does not, the defaulting party loses. In this particular case, the defaulting party wins. I was also intrigued by the last line in this letter at the very bottom, the disclaimer, which says in part that any person who knowingly conceals information from their insurance company is guilty of a crime or can be held civilly liable. I don't know what the answer is here, but it just struck me as fundamentally unfair. And I don't think that this happens a lot. I don't think it happens a lot. I think that most people that are involved in accidents are responsible, and they call upon their insurance company to help them out. And when that happens, the person who caused the accident replies to their insurance company, and everything is resolved. In this case, it was a little bit different, $800 issue. So the car that was struck ended up paying a $500 deductible, and then relied on their insurance carrier to go into arbitration to try and secure repayment of that deductible and the additional $300 that was in play. Now, again, good insurance companies step forward and they say, I don't care whether it's $300 or $3,000 or $300,000. If it's not my client's fault, I'm going to go to arbitration and try to pursue this. But again, with how much enthusiasm when what's in play here is an extra $300, which may well be more than the cost of the arbitration involved for the company pursuing it. And once again, the driver who was the victim of the accident is left to pay the deductible and wonder what to do next. You know, in this particular case, I can tell you that the owners of the vehicle just didn't leave it at that. They contracted the policyholders company several times. they had several extended conversations with the people that were reviewing the claim. They were told repeatedly that the claim is denied. They were told repeatedly that they'd made every single effort they could to contact the other driver. So the owner of this vehicle then just went online and spent 5 minutes on Facebook and Google, tracked down the driver, and called the insurance company with the phone number where they could be reached at work. And ultimately, the issue was resolved in the favor of the person who was driving the vehicle that was struck. This isn't going to be a huge issue, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I don't know that it affects a whole lot of people, but I think there's an issue of fundamental fairness here, that you do everything right, and the other party simply refuses to engage in the conversation, and they win and you lose. And that's why I brought this to your attention, and I appreciate the opportunity to share it with you now at this committee meeting, and be happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you, Representative. And colleagues, this is our only hearing today, and we have 2 hours, so you feel free to pepper him with any and every question about any topic, anything.
I want to make sure Stark gets home early, though.
Okay, good.
However, Madam Chair, I'll remind you, some of us have a 3-plus-hour drive this
evening. Okay.
So, I've got a couple questions.
Okay, good. Any questions or comments for Representative Gomberg or Representative Nierman?
So I have a question. Did the victimized party, did they file anything or bring anything up with, like, the insurance commissioner or anything like that?
In this particular case, Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, first thing they did is they filed a DMV accident report. There was no police report because there is no police involved in this case. So they filed an accident report, which was submitted with the claim. When the claim was initially denied, they also contacted the insurance division and their consumer division to at least explain and outline what had happened. And I don't know how that was resolved, because ultimately at the end of the process, the claim was approved when they were finally able to reach the driver of the second vehicle after an extensive internet search lasting about 3 to 7 minutes. And so the claim that had been denied several times was later approved.
So it sounds to me part of the issue is that it's kind of in that no man's land of enough of amount of money to be meaningful. They're out $500, right, that they had to pay for their deductible. But it's not such a huge amount of money that you want to go get the armies of attorneys, scaling the walls or anything like that. So it's kind of in that no man's land there of that middle zone there. So do you have a remedy that you're proposing, or just
Madam Chair, I just came from a meeting that had co-chairs, and we've been saying that all day long. Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, sure, there's always the option of contacting an attorney, and I believe in cases like this that those attorneys could recover fees. But I don't think that there would be much in the way of damages at stake here, so I don't know how valuable it is for the attorneys that would pursue it as well. When there's a dispute between insurance companies, they go to arbitration, and so they are spending their arbitrating time over $300 issue here. Remedies? I'm at a bit of a loss here. The remedy is that the responsible people should do good things. That being said, we're required to have insurance and provide proof of insurance, but apparently we're not required to utilize the insurance that we're required to carry. I find that very curious.
Representative Rayfield.
And so I think the part of the context is, from an insurance company perspective, is you have folks that are sitting in a cubicle or in an office, if they're fortunate enough, right, as an adjuster situation, and they're trying to determine whether this is a valid or not valid claim. And so part of the problem in this situation that probably presented for this adjuster is, as they came in, they said, okay, if everybody came up to me and said their car had been damaged, and they said, was this really, did you just back into something? I don't have anything to corroborate this. And so they're stuck without this information, right? But the insurance company should have and does have that duty to investigate, as you did, right, where you were able to quickly place a phone call, find this. The coincidental nature of this is I've had a very similar situation personally when I was was actually in law school where somebody T-boned my car, and they wouldn't take responsibility for it because they couldn't contact the driver. But there was also a communication barrier, and it took forever to actually get them to accept liability. There are these things. I don't think it's unique to any given situation. I think these things do happen. But I think that, and you're right, that from, and Representative Nierman, that as an attorney, in a situation like this, especially where the damages are under $10,000, there's a process whereby an attorney can send what they call a 20080 letter, or as 20.080, where you can demand $10,000 or less. If GEICO in this situation were not to respond to that and they were to deny liability, you would then file a lawsuit. And in this case, you'd prove your case because they wouldn't show up. If the people continued not to show up, you'd prove your case and you'd get all your attorney fees. The incentive behind that is if you go to arbitration or if it got appealed to the trial court level, the GEICO or whatever insurance company would be paying $15,000 to $25,000, you know, in attorney fees. The really bad thing about that is you've now dragged that individual throughout that process on a claim where they never should have had to get an attorney in the first place. So the question is, how do you, you know, understand the implications of the insurance company knowing that they need to document their claim, right, to make sure that when they give a dollar out, they have justification for that in the file, but at the same time making sure that that consumer is being taken care of, right? And that's kind of the policy question.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment really quickly. One of the issues that was raised in this case when they were unable to reach their policyholder is that they needed to confirm that their policyholder was really the person involved with this. They wanted to make sure that there was no fraud, that somebody didn't steal the car, somebody didn't borrow the car, somebody didn't impersonate the driver of the car, that the policyholder was actually the person involved in the accident. I get that. I completely get that. I would just hope that a policyholder that receives numerous contacts, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. right. from insurance companies saying, we're told that you were involved in an accident, would pick up the phone and say, heck no, I wasn't.
Right.
Somebody borrowed my car. Somebody stole my car. Somebody impersonated me.
Right.
I think it's a question of who the burden should be on. And at the end of the day, if people refuse to respond, whether the people that did everything right lose or the people that did everything wrong lose.
One question throughout, just, and I know that you just brought this issue up to us, you might not even had the answer to or the time to investigate this, and maybe DCBS will know. This obviously is a GEICO issue. Do you know this is a policy that, you know, State Farm and other Progressive and other car insurance companies have, or is this a policy? I mean, obviously, I guess we'll hear from DCBS. It seems like it's probably an allowable policy under the law, but whether or not other insurance companies also have this policy, do you have any idea?
Only anecdotal information, Madam Chair. And you notice that I was cautious not to name names, name companies, or anything else in the process of this conversation, not trying to point fingers at any particular company. My sense is that this may not be isolated to one particular company. I can't say for certain whether one company applies this practice more frequently than others. In the course of researching this, I was told that this isn't unusual. But I can't tell you numbers, and I can't narrow it to particular practitioners.
Interesting. Any other final comments or questions for our colleague? Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks so much again for the invitation to come here and share this story with you.
Great.
Thanks so much.
And then our final panel is going to be T.K. Keen and Rick Blackwell from DCBS. A PowerPoint.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is T.K. Keen, and I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation. Along with me today is Rick Blackwell, our Senior Policy Manager, and what we're going to do is split this presentation regarding insurer liability for these types of issues into two parts. Rick is going to cover the substantial portions of the motor vehicle code, and the insurance code, and I'm going to talk about the work of our consumer advocates and how other states deal with this issue. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rick.
Thank you. And again, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager at DFR, the agent or the division that used to be the insurance division in finance and corporate securities. So in case you want to make that clear. Yeah, PowerPoint. So you have so much time, figured we'd put on a nice presentation. So our mission, the mission of DFR is to protect Oregonians' access to fair products and services through education, regulation, and customer assistance. And we'll get into that as we go through the presentation. So what are Oregon drivers' responsibilities? So under the vehicle code, everyone has a duty to meet damages that are caused by the ownership or operation of a motor vehicle. So everyone that gets on the road has this general legal obligation. Now, not all of us are liquid, right? I mean, I don't think personally a lot of people on the road could cover the entire damages of an accident they cause. So in the alternative, the vehicle code says you can meet your financial responsibility requirements, which is to meet your damages, by also having a liability insurance policy. So this is it's a function of just being able to operate a vehicle on the roadway or some roadway that's open for public use. And of course, we all know that you have to carry proof of that insurance with you at all times when you're driving. Failure to do that is a Class B traffic violation, which is essentially a penalty without certain prison time. It's not a misdemeanor, so no, you know, up to a year of prison. There's duties that people have in the event of an accident under the vehicle code. As a matter of law, you're supposed to immediately stop, and that's immediately, not 2 minutes later. Just you have to stop as soon as you can. And then you give to the other driver, passenger, your name and address, your registration number, and the name and addresses of the other occupants of the vehicle. This is just a duty that all of us have as we drive, and failure to do so is a Class A misdemeanor. And actually, a court can award damages to someone that fails to carry this out. So if you don't give your name and address and your registration number as part of the accident, in the event that it went to court, criminal court, the judge could then also say you owe all the damages that are due because of what the damage that you caused. So, you know, by law, drivers are already supposed to be giving this information, and that's suitable to locate them in the event of going through the back and forth of figuring out who's liable. The liability policies that are in place, the liability policies in place, I apologize, I don't usually give PowerPoints to the committee. So. The vehicle code says that you have to have a liability policy that meets certain dollar thresholds, but then it goes back to the insurance code to say what's actually in the policy. And so, you know, the vehicle code says $25,000 injury or death, $50,000 for two, and $20,000 for property damage. That's the minimums for all liability coverage for operating a motor vehicle. Now, under the insurance code, policies can exclude certain individuals due to driving records or for reasons that we established by rule previously. So under rule right now, it's if you've had a license suspended or revoked, that's a reason to be excluded from a policy. And also if you have someone on the policy that would cause an economic hardship to you as the insured, so their rates are so high that you would actually have a $1,000 difference if they were on or off the policy. So those are really the criteria right now as far as excluding people from liability. Policies have to include liability for all the family members. And then exclusions are only allowed as outlined in rule. Exclusions can apply to liability coverage, but exclusion of uninsured, underinsured, and PIP, personal injury protection, are not. You cannot exclude those. Those are also statutory defaults. So, how is liability assigned in an auto accident? And by this, I don't mean who was actually at fault, not the investigative side, but who's actually going to pay. Under the insurance code, an insurer's liability for motor vehicle liability policies is absolute when there's injury or damage covered by the policy. So, if the event occurs, their liability is absolute. We'll get into that later as to what that means in terms of unfair claim settlement practices. We have a hybrid system between a traditional and a no-fault auto insurance liability system. So a victim may still sue a driver who is legal at fault for damages or injuries sustained by the event. And then as a statutory default, Oregon requires drivers to carry personal injury protection coverage which is covering the policyholder's own bodily injury, not the property damage. And I think that's a distinction we'll need to talk about in a minute. But unlike other no-fault systems throughout the United States, Oregon doesn't limit the accident victim's right to sue before the PIP limits have been exhausted. The maximum deductible for PIP coverage under the insurance code is $250, so the most that you pay for PIP is $250. But PIP has to be paid promptly after a proof of loss, which is kind of a formal statement that, you know, this is, you have loss and this is what the damages are. So when PIP is primary or excess, and by that I mean primary, is that it applies immediately and it's not dependent on whether other insurance coverage is exhausted. Really depends on who's in the car and who is related to the insured. So family members and the insured themselves, immediately. So that coverage applies immediately. Insureds and family that are injured in a car not covered by the policy, that's excess. So you have other insurance that has to run out first before you can apply PIP coverage. But under PIP, no matter who's at fault, insurance is paying for reasonable medical, hospital, medical expenses, disability, and certain payments for essential services. In terms of non-cooperation, there is case law, at least from 1980 on, the still good law that basically says that if an auto accident victim sues the insurer, non-cooperation by the other insured is not a defense to liability. And so now this is in a lawsuit setting. If that's how that works in a regulatory context, I couldn't answer for the committee at this point. But basically, there is a line of case law that says if the person is not cooperating, that's not a defense in the court action. But setting all that aside, insurers under the insurance code can still establish proof of loss requirements. So they can investigate and determine loss through claims adjusters and then negotiate with the persons that are repairing the losses. So I already went through proof of loss. And finally, we look to the contract to see if the insurer, the insured, agreed on when liability attaches. There is a standard set of forms put out by the Insurance Services Office, or ISO, that basically says you as an insured have a duty to cooperate in all the investigations and everything. And if you don't do that, that could actually make a difference in whether you're still covered or not. So contracts are still dependent on certain default consumer protections in the insurance code. So for instance, in the event that there's a dispute about whether whether coverage applies because of physical damage, then the code allows the insured to ask for an independent appraisal, but it still has to be within the policy itself. So as long as the policy covers that contingency, then there's a right to be able to ask for it. And at this point, I think I will go ahead and – no, actually, I'm not. We're not there yet. Okay. What happens to insureds that don't cooperate? So as I noted earlier, there's a contractual duty to cooperate with your insurer when there's an accident. Under the insurance code, insurers can cancel policies for several reasons, which includes not paying premiums, fraud and material misrepresentations, and I think including in this context, failing to abide by the terms and conditions of the policy. So if the policy says you must cooperate, if you fail to comply with that policy, thus you may lose your coverage. The insureds that fail to report accidents might also be treated as an uninsured motorist, but that also really depends on whether you've been injured or not. So in an injury situation, uninsured motorist coverage is going to cover what damages are legally due to you because of the accident. But UM coverage does not apply when there's just property damage. So I want to make that clear. You can buy elective uninsured motorist coverage to cover property damage. Has to be offered, and you are able to accept it, but it's an elective coverage, and it's not always applicable. So if a consumer didn't actually get that coverage up front, it's questionable whether they can be treated. They can use the uninsured motorist coverage. If there's an issue with the victim's insurance company or the other company that should be or is evaluating the claims. The insurance code also has what we call the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act, and that really goes through prohibiting insurers from failing to acknowledge and act on claims, failing to adopt and implement reasonable standards for the prompt investigation of those claims, refusing to pay them out before there's been an investigation based on all available information, and then engaging in other practices that are not necessarily defined but would act as an unjust or unfair act on the insurance buying public. Okay, so at this point now I will turn it back over to TK.
There appears to be a question here.
So when you talk about non-cooperation there, so I'm trying to connect the dots between Representative Gomberg's presentation and yours. Are you kind of implying that this the person that didn't reply to the insurer was not cooperating is in this case? Or?
Well, I think we can speak. I think TK will speak to more of that in a minute. But the in terms of like our independent look at the case, we tried to reach out to the person that had the issue and was unable to reach them. I mean, there's only so much that we can do independently. We need to have the cooperation of the person that made the complaint.
So you're saying just in general, you would try to reach out to someone. You didn't actually do anything in this case here, right?
Well, and I think the rest, I mean, moving forward, I think we can answer that question.
Okay,
you.
I'll wait.
Yeah.
Just from like a non-cooperation issue on this would be between the insurer and its member.
Right.
So that wouldn't be something that necessarily, and that would be actually potentially dependent upon the language in the contract between the insurer and the insured. So that, for instance, if I was GEICO in the situation and I said, you know, hey, you're not cooperating, then there would have to be sufficient facts for them to be defined as not cooperating under their policy to then disqualify them from actually paying on the policy.
Because there's kind of a, if you don't mind, there's kind of a, like a little bit of a conflict of interest here because GEICO's incentivized to not pay on any claim. I mean, any insurer would kind of be incentivized to do that. And they're also incentivized to keep the policy intact. And so there doesn't seem to be any kind of incentive to force them to cooperate, which kind of sounds like what happened here. So, okay. Just trying to figure it all out.
Okay. So just to continue on. So So to your question, Representative Nierman, we did receive the information from Representative Gomberg about this specific incident, and we reached out to the consumer, and we didn't get a response back. So it sounds like, resolved, and based on the email chain that I saw, it was in this particular case. But that's pretty normal protocol for us when we become aware of a consumer issue, even if they're not making a formal complaint, to go ahead and reach out and gather whatever information we're able to. So to move forward with options for accident victims here, so as Rick had mentioned, there is this it's most common for victims to attempt to access the insurance of the at-fault driver and also PIP if it's applicable. As Rick had mentioned, there are occasions where uninsured motorist coverage may pick up, and depending on the factual scenario, where there may be some other remedies available to the driver that was not at fault, but that generally is, as Representative Gomberg described, is what occurs in most of these complaints. And as Rick had mentioned, victims have access to through the division to the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act, which require the insurers to timely communicate back to the policyholders and the parties involved to fairly investigate and timely investigate complaints and also claims and any additional practices that the division deems injurious to the insurance buying public would be included in that. And certainly we would consider if an insurer were to just, for example, outright deny claims based on the non-cooperation of their insured, that to be one of those practices, and we have approached that as such. So go ahead. So just to provide some context, we do see quite a few complaints in a given year. In 2015, we had 3,700 complaints to the division. Of those, 1,091 involved auto complaints, and we had six specific complaints on this subject. Each of those complaints was resolved in compliance with the insurance code and was made by the third-party victim and was resolved to their satisfaction. What we generally do in terms of communication with insurers when we receive a complaint such as this or on any insurance issue is reach out to the carriers immediately and gather back in their facts and their the details they have about the complaint. We also provide insurers back communication about what's considered industry or regulatory best practices in these sorts of incidents. And so for non-cooperative insureds that belong to them, we let them know that we expect them to do basic research such as Google searches, social media searches, try to find the person based on DMV records or talking to the agent that sold them the policy to see if they maybe have an address update or additional information to provide, ensure that the carrier attempted to contact the non-cooperating party outside of normal 8-to-5 work hours. It's just some basic common sense things you would do when you're trying to locate somebody. Failure to do that and failure to make best efforts to complete an investigation timely and to find the parties involved, especially if it's deemed a non-cooperating party by the insurer, could fall under, or we could take enforcement action for insurers that didn't, or against insurers that failed to do that under the insurance code. So. Okay, so just highlights of what some other states are doing in this arena. This body of law specific to the non-cooperation of insureds is fairly well settled at this point. There have been two states that have provided recent guidance, and that was based on their own state Supreme Court cases. Nevada and Delaware both track Oregon law involving the non-cooperation of insureds issue in that insurers do not escape liability merely because the insured did not cooperate. And finally, as part of the FAQs, the New Jersey Division of Insurance it points to uninsured motorist coverage as one possible avenue of recovery for victims. And so with that, I'll stop and just see if there are any additional questions.
So I'm trying to understand this, though. So going back to Representative Gomberg's situation where his constituent received this letter from the insurance company of the at-fault driver and basically dismisses this claim because their policyholder didn't respond, it would seem like that what I'm hearing is that does not relieve, in this case, GEICO, of responsibility to the driver that got hit. Is that correct? And therefore, Representative Gomberg's constituent that got hit should get reimbursed by GEICO, which would then try to take action against their policyholder, I'm assuming.
Chair Fagan and Representative Holvey, I think what we could say in that case is that because of absolute liability and other provisions, they're not, that the insurer in question wouldn't be relieved from liability. Yeah.
Paula? Can you think of one?
Well, I'm just wondering how that plays out because it evidently didn't play out very well. I guess it resolved itself, but it wasn't really timely. But I guess ultimately, why would an insurance company send a letter like this if they knew they were liable and that non-response was not a defense? That they would go ahead and pay this claim and then, seek their remedy from their policyholder. Why are they allowed to send a letter like this?
Right, and that is an issue, Representative Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, that is an issue we're following up on.
Rep. McLean.
Well, mine is a little bit different. I appreciate my first question has already just been asked by the last representative, but the next, I just spent 2.5 hours in a transportation committee meeting this morning that was talking about technology and how we're going to have driverless cars, or at least we're going to have cars that are going to be 3/4 driverless. You know, and the 1/4 is when you're overriding if something happens with the program or things like that. And it just brought up all kinds of interesting insurance questions, actually about some things that relate to this. And that's, you know, who do you contact anyway? You know, as far as if there's deadlines for insurance policies on when you have to have your reports in and who you're trying to find. You know, I mean, there may be technology and you can buy another app that basically tells you who the car, you know, is owned by, whether it be General Motors or whether it be Lyft or Uber or somebody else. But it's not going to be necessarily owned by an individual. And then there will be the times where you'll have individuals that will not have been in charge. And they kept saying that this was going to happen within 2 years. And all I could think of was the insurance company better have a work group. Because it was a situation where, again, this is, you know, this is a situation where you know who supposedly, you know, has the policy, or you know who, you know, needs to be contacted. You've only got a couple parties to go after or look at. But in this other scenario, there's a whole different arena. And I was just wondering if the state's insurance, or what are we called now? What are you called?
Division of Financial Regulation.
Okay, well, yeah. Your Division of Financial Regulations, if you have a work group that's talking about all these new issues that technology is putting upon us pretty quickly.
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, we have been looking at that issue because we have been fielding inquiries from folks that operate the software to that technology and also people who are interested in putting more of those vehicles on the roads in Oregon. And so how those kind of products are insured is something that our staff is working on right now and involved in not only a discussion with industry, but also with national regulators as far as how other states may approach this and starting to formulate some ideas around best practices and things of that sort.
And then the city of Portland just became, we found out today, one of 7 smart cities that are basically hoping for a $70 million grant or award to actually put some of these things into effect in the next 3 years. So it seems like it's pretty important. And I heard that you were sort of involved in a few conversations with ODOT.
Yes.
But I think it's really important for us to be pretty aggressive, because if we think this is an issue, I mean, it looks to me like this is just the tip of the iceberg on some things that we'll be looking or facing when we have some of this new technology.
Yeah, Chair Fagan and Representative McLean, yeah, that is absolutely correct. And that's why we want to be on the cutting edge of the new technology, whether it is an insurance product or a financial product or an application that somehow allows people to access those kind of interfaces, but also be on the cutting edge of whatever new opportunities there are being offered, you know, on the roadways in terms of driverless vehicles and things of that sort.
So to follow up on that,
yeah.
As I was just creatively thinking as I was listening to all of this morning, the first thing, you know, there's going to be a car, they have it in stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and they're talking about, you know, you can be in charge of the car 60% of the time or 70% of the time, or on every action except for braking and cornering, you know. And so it looks to me like you guys are going to have all kinds of levels of new language, because, you know, driver's error is supposedly, what, 94% of the issue that they're talking about here. But also there's going to have to be transitional insurance that talks about when they're testing all this out and trying to figure out, you know, specifically where are the glitches in the software program and the sensors program, and what happens when the sensor goes out, then who's in charge, and basically who's going to be liable.
Right, Representative or Vice Chair Rayford, Representative McLean. Yeah, that those are all issues, especially around the timing of when the products are put in or put on the roadway, and also the testing of those, and when somebody may be liable, or what software is controlling the device when, are all aspects of what we are looking at for sure.
I have one more.
Please.
It's who the person is. That's, you know, I mean, when you're in this car and you're just a passenger, okay? I mean, that's kind of like the ride share approach. But then there are also going to be some of these cars that you can kind of just call up and it'll come to you. And then you get to be the driver, kind of, part of the time. And so, I mean, there's different levels of what the technology does, and then there's different levels of how involved the human being is. And they didn't talk about robots yet, you know, taking over. But, you know, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? I'm not, I really am serious, because it just, I couldn't even imagine us getting that figured out in 2 years.
Oh, yeah, no, and Vice Chair Rayfield, Representative McLean. Yes, we've had several insurers actually come in and discuss the timing issues and the control issues, especially when a car is dispatched, you know, what kind of insurance that might require versus when it is semi-controlled by a human being versus, you know, who's in charge of the braking in that instance and things of that sort and what that might look like. It is a body of insurance law that, as you've noted, is in the works, and we are going to have to respond quickly to that. I'm confident that we can and to address the liability issues on our roadways in that manner. There is just enough inertia and enough national conversation about it that I feel like with our policy team, we can put forth whatever statutes or rules or guidance is needed to ensure that consumers are protected.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Are there any other questions? Representative Volvi.
I didn't have a question. I just want to see if you call on me. Are you going to change your name again? I'm having a tough time with financial regulation, I guess.
Better take that one.
I hope not.
Very well, very well. So if you do want to know about driverless cars, there are a lot of laws that would still apply, and there wouldn't be as many issues as people think there were with the existing laws for liability components. But that's a whole – I did write a six-piece blog on driverless cars, if you guys are all interested. I'll get you some copy, Holby.
I was wondering if they could explain total loss, you know, to remind me what it's all about.
Representative Stark, have a safe drive. Have a safe drive. You really want them in? Okay. All right, with that said, thank you guys very much. We'll go ahead and close the informational session and close the meeting, adjourn the meeting. Informational session and close the meeting, adjourn the meeting. We'll go ahead and close the information.